I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Beam me up on the mamas of all mama shit.
Hey, I'm looking through my telescope and I see a mothership. Is that you? Beam me up.
Hey, D.A., I'm thirsty, man. Can you beam me up for a cold one?
Hey, D.A., what's going on, baby? Stop me off and beam me up.
D.A., what's the dealio? Permission to get in that mothership.
Is my window seat still available? Beam me up.
What's going on, D.A.? Hey, man, I need you to do me a huge favor. My co-worker's a jerk. Oh, just beam me up, man.
Get beamed up. Everyone else has. It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
And we come to you live from the Quicken Loans studios. National mortgage lender Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. Coming up this hour on the show, we grade out Jason Witten's debut as the number one analyst on Monday Night Football. That comes your way in about 18 minutes from now. Also, the author of the new book about the ill-fated USFL Football League from the early 80s, Jeff Perlman, Football for a Buck is the book. I can't put it down. He'll join us coming up here at about 40 minutes past the hour. In Oakland, the Raiders licking their wounds after an opening night loss against the Rams, where, by and large, they were competitive in the first three quarters, and then in the fourth quarter, the walls fell down. John Gruden's going to have his work cut out for him because there is massive attention on him because of who he is. And also his contract, 10 years, $100 million. You make $10 million a year for 10 years. You have the name of John Gruden. You have clearly parlayed that into a monster contract. Nobody else has a 10-year, $100 million deal. Well, you're going to have some pressure and expectations pretty quickly. And John Gruden is walking a very bizarre line to me. He is trying, I think, to sell the fan base that we're not very good this year. We have to temper expectations. I'm not bringing this team back to the Super Bowl already. We need to restock the farm system, if you will. We need to get better drafts. We need to flesh out this roster with depth. He has been saying that. And yet, on the other hand, he is signing veteran aging free agents seemingly as stopgaps right now. If you are truly rebuilding, and that's why you traded away Khalil Mack, what you are saying is we're not ready to win right now. So then why would you sign Jordy Nelson? Why would you sign Doug Martin? Why would you trade for A.J. McCarron? Why would you have traded for Martavis Bryant? Martavis Bryant has talent. We've seen that in Pittsburgh, but the guy didn't have his head screwed on straight, has had two different NFL suspensions, and they traded a third-round pick for him. That's not chump change. Then they cut him before the season. Well, if that wasn't bizarre enough, oh yeah, let's just trade away a three for a guy that won't even make the team. It seemed like Martavis Bryant was going to be suspended for the year. Now, no suspension has been announced. We're through week one. The Raiders have lost, and they've re-signed Martavis Bryant. So maybe he's in the middle of an appeal process that the Raiders feel like they can get a couple of weeks out of him. Maybe they think he's going to win his appeal. But is it bizarre to have this much misdirection when it comes to what the focus should be if you're the Raiders? John Gruden is out there before the game high-fiving the fans of the black hole. Fired up. Yeah, I'm back in Oakland. They're going to pay all this money to Derek Carr. And yet, they're planning to not be very good. I thought John Gruden also lost me when on Monday night he said Khalil Mack didn't want to be here. Didn't want to be here. I find that hard to believe. Had you offered him the same amount of money he got from Chicago, my guess is he would have wanted to be there. But he realized, or his agent realized, your market value is far higher than what you are being compensated with right here. Now, John Gruden going out and trying to spin the PR of he was under contract and he didn't report, he didn't want to be here, is silly. It's silly. What ended up happening was Khalil Mack and his agent recognized his value was way higher outside of those walls. Guys, who won that deal? Khalil Mack or John Gruden? Khalil Mack did. Because Khalil Mack got all of the money. He knew somebody was willing to pay him all of the money, and it wasn't the Raiders. So don't sell me that he didn't want to be there. I'm sure he had friendships. I'm sure he had bonds there. That was a team he was drafted by. But more so, if you would pay him equitably to what he would get somewhere else, he'd stay. But you wouldn't. So the spin-off, he didn't want to be here, I thought was very dishonest and disingenuous. But how can you, if you're John Gruden, look at your fan base, high-five them, chest-bump them, and tell them, well, you know, we're not very good. We're trying to reload right now. But we're going to spend a lot of money on an aging free agent like Doug Martin or Jordy Nelson, or trade a third-round pick for Martavis Bryant, or trade a pick for A.J. McCarron. Are you looking to stockpile picks? Because that's what you do with Khalil Mack, and that supposedly was why you had to trade him, because you openly said that there's no talent here because we have not gotten anything out of the 15, 16, and 17 drafts. Okay, so draft picks are important, but you're trading a third-round pick away from Martavis Bryant? But you're trading a pick away for A.J. McCarron? You already have your franchise quarterback. What sense did this roster build make? I'd like to know. And now they bring back Martavis Bryant. I don't get it. I think what is happening is John Gruden walked into this situation because he could not say no. It was too much money. John Gruden wasn't coming back for $4 million a year, that's for sure. This is not some type of passion project where he said, I've got to do this to finish my legacy. I mean, I love the hokey, I'm here because Tom Brady stole a Super Bowl appearance away from me in 2001. I mean, come on. John Gruden was driven in 2018 to return because once upon a time, Tom Brady stole away a championship from him. So 17 years later, he's back, but he was able to take 7 years off of coaching. In that time, Tom Brady was playing. He didn't want to get revenge on him then, but now he suddenly does. No, the fact is, this was an offer too good to refuse. And I get that. I totally get it. My first love would not be doing NPR radio. It wouldn't be spinning jazz tunes. Nothing wrong with it, but that's not where my passion lies. But if NPR was like, DA, we need you. We have to have you. And here's a 10-year, $100 million contract to play jazz and to talk NPR news. I'd go, all right, sorry, Mraz, sorry, Bilotti, sorry, Bogish, but I got to take this. This is John Gruden, an offer too good to refuse. Then he walks in there and realizes, and my name and my following and this Raider fan base is really into this, and man, I don't feel comfortable snuffing out their dreams right now. So let's try to be kind of good. And I like Jordy Nelson, and I like Doug Martin. And you know what? Maybe Martavis Bryant does. I can get through to him. Maybe I can give Derek Carr another target here. And you know what? Maybe we can be all right. And then he gets criticized because he's got to trade away Khalil Mack because in his mind, hey, man, you got to want to play for me. You want to play for the Raiders. And you're not calling me. I mean, I shouldn't have to call you. And then he trades Khalil Mack, and he's in this embarrassing standoff, and he has to trade him. And now suddenly he gets defensive and goes, well, there's no talent here anyway. We're not getting anything out of the 15, 16, and 17 drafts. So we need draft picks. And then suddenly people go, oh, Chucky got owned in that. And Khalil Mack's going to have a beast season. And he comes off on a Sunday night and wrecks shop into something historically dominant to the first half against the Packers. And what does Gruden have to say? But he has to save face and say, well, he didn't want to be here anyway. He didn't want to be here. Again, defensive. This is not a good look for John Gruden early. Martavis Bryant is good enough to trade a third-round pick for, but then not good enough to make the team, but then good enough to re-sign when nobody else in the NFL wants him because he's radioactive. What? Your toll-free line is 855-212-4227. Brought to you by Geico. Great news. Quick way you could save money switching to Geico. Go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Mike is next up. He's in California listening online to CBS Sports Radio. What's up, Mike?
Well, I just want to remind you that this is the way of the old Raiders. Remember when they used to go grab those players who had a couple years left?
Yeah.
Ted Hendricks, Lyle Alzado, Jim Plunkett, and they won.
Yeah.
So go back to history of the Raiders, and they did what kind of what Belichick does, is pick guys up at the end of their career. They know they get one or two more years out of them. So you can have those older players.
Okay, so, but let's recognize this, Mike. You brought up teams of the 70s and 80s when they won in 1980, 1983. They kept trying to do that into the 90s and early 2000s, and it was a debacle.
It was in a way, but there are times.
In a way, they had an entire decade that was lost. They were one of the worst franchises of the NFL for 10 years.
And that comes from success, is that you get those low picks and things like this, and they weren't into those picks.
No, that's not fair to say, because they were still finishing 4-12, 5-11, 3-13, and they were blowing Jamarcus Russell. They were blowing Darius Hayward Bay. They were blowing Robert Gallery. They had high picks. Don't sell it like they were the Patriots.
But this is a different coach, too.
Okay, so now you're slip-sliding around your argument.
I mean, that was the Al Davis way, and I think that they can go back to it, and I think it can work.
Well, it didn't work in the latter days of Al Davis. It worked when you had John Madden and Hall of Fame players like Biletnikoff and Ken Stabler. Those were Hall of Famers. That look at that offensive line. Art Shell, Jim Otto. That was one of the greatest offensive lines ever. Eugene Upshaw. And so they were supplementing a great team with cast-off veterans. This is not that type of team.
Good point.
I mean, think about the defensive backs, Jack Tatum. I mean, all of those guys, the cornerbacks, Mike Haynes, Lester Hayes, everybody. These are dominant Hall of Fame players. John Gruden doesn't have that right now. Nick is next up in Tennessee, listening on 640 WXSM. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing good. First off, I just got to say this. Having worked at an NPR affiliate station for years, I would kill to hear you on All Things Considered and begging people to send in their listener contributions. That'd be great.
No, I appreciate that.
I mean, I think you could do it. I think you could definitely drive in some funds.
If there's $100 million on it, I'll do it.
I bet you would, man. You could work all the shows. But let me just throw this. You would think the Raiders, the previous caller mentioned they do this with the players. They do this with the coaches. They brought Art Shell back 10 years past his use-by date. They brought in a coach. I forget his name, but he worked at a bed and breakfast, and then they made him the head coach. I can see his face. I can't think of his name. And now this. You would think after a while somebody would go to Mark Davis and say, you know, there's a Frank Reich. There's that hot young coordinator. Why don't we give this guy a try? Because the way we have been doing it has not worked.
Well, it's the sentimentality of John Gruden. I mean, Mark Davis wants to go back to the good old days. The last good old days was the John Gruden days of the early 2000s. And they were really good. And Gruden did a good job of coaching that thing up. And they had put together a really good team. But that's a problem. It's always been a problem. When you go back based on nostalgia. You know, Carl Peterson did this once upon a time in Kansas City with Dick Vermeil. Dick Vermeil had gotten him to a Super Bowl in Philadelphia, and Carl Peterson, 15 years later, said, I want Dick Vermeil again. Well, Dick Vermeil had spent, more than a decade out of football and then come back with the Rams and basically burned himself out within 3 years again and came back. They were fine. They were fine. But, you know, Dick was far removed from those brilliant years of the late 70s, early 80s. It's very hard to go back again. Look at Joe Gibbs, 2.0 in Washington. Mark Davis wanted to capture the magic again of John Gruden, but I'll say this. I'm skeptical that you can recapture magic. Sometimes you got to move on. And early returns for me on Gruden are not good. We'll continue with your phone calls on the Raiders situation at 855-212-4CBS, 855-212-4227. Twitter, DA on CBS. Also, let's grade out Jason Witten's night number one on Monday Night Football, because the media critique was not pretty to him yesterday after the Monday night debut. DA, CBS Sports Radio.
A no sweatpants at work zone.
The reason I've listened since overnight is you and Mraz bring the insight. You bring the honesty. You bring the stuff we want to hear. It is the cheese talk.
It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
The cheese talk. That's what we do around here. The DA show every single morning right here on CBS Sports Radio. If it's not heard in your area, listen to us on Sirius XM channel 206. That's Sirius XM channel 206, as well as on your phone. Download the CBS Sports app and listen to us there. We're also on radio.com and on Apple Music. The long, tough road to Super Bowl 53 on CBS continues with a great doubleheader this weekend. Kansas City collides with Pittsburgh, then it's a rematch of the AFC title game. New England battles Jacksonville. The day kicks off at 12 Eastern with the NFL Today, presented by Jeep. Jason's next up. He's in Phoenix, listening on Sirius XM channel 206. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, DA. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure. What's going on?
Hey, you know, I love the show, man. I listen every day on the way to work, but I gotta say that I disagree with your assessment of Oakland right now. I watched the game, and, you know, first thing is, if you look at the Rams, they're almost everybody's favorite to get to the Super Bowl, if not win the Super Bowl. You know, Vegas odds on them are better than just about any team right now, but I thought Oakland played really well. I thought they came out in that game. I thought they punched him in the mouth. And I saw a lot of you know, John Gruden in the team, old John Gruden in the team at the beginning of them. I mean, that defense is stacked with the Rams, but, you know, deeper into that, nobody is going to know. Everybody, it's overreaction Tuesday. Every time I hear Tuesday, everything's the end of the world. But if you look at it, you know, I'm a huge Packer fan, and I saw what Khalil Mack did. But nobody's going to know the ramifications of that trade for a couple years until you see what he gets in picks in Oakland. It's going to be really hard to determine if that was a good trade or a bad trade. I mean, everybody's saying on the surface now it looks like it's bad, but nobody knows that. If they get to the Super Bowl in 3 years from now, is that still a bad trade? And I can tell you this, all those veterans they brought in, you know, you've got players, you can add all their contracts together, and it's not going to be close to what they were going to pay Khalil Mack. So you can bring them in, have some good veteran leadership, and get these guys going in the right direction. And I don't blame John Gruden. You got to be respectable your first year. You can't commit to it and have a 2-win season your first deal back, or you're going to be, I mean, the world's going to end. So,
well, let me jump in there, Jason. I think you can jump in there if you're ever going to jump in there and be 2-14 on the first year of a $100 million deal. If there's ever a time to do it, it's John Gruden, because he has total job security. He is paid for another 9 years. Doesn't matter if the Wolves come out. He can do whatever he wants. He's got a decade-long guaranteed contract. Number two, I would agree. The Raiders were competitive in the first three quarters of that game. But let's not let anything fool you. The Rams had not played a down in the preseason for their starting offense. Not a down. Nobody on their starting offense played in the preseason. So you think they were rusty? Sean McVay didn't want to risk any injury. Fine. But that's what you got. Also, there's no doubt you can't grade out John Gruden draft picks until he actually makes them. But what are the odds he drafts an NFL Defensive Player of the Year, a multi-time All-Pro Pro Bowler that eventually could become a Hall of Famer? I mean, Khalil Mack is already on that trajectory. He's the best defensive player in the NFL, arguably. John Gruden's going to have to draft one of those guys. That's hard, no matter how many picks you have. There's only one of those guys in the league. And I'm not even talking about how they played on Monday night. I'm talking about the roster construction of a guy that says one thing in my mind and is doing another. Jason Witten had his Monday night debut, and the media critics were not kind to him yesterday. And I talked about this yesterday in the morning before I read anybody. I thought he was really underwhelming. I thought he was at times awkward and uncomfortable, at times very underwhelming. I don't mind a guy that doesn't have a lot of personality as long as you're bringing me solid X's and O's and you're comfortable on camera. You don't have to be a shtick artist. You don't have to be a clown. You don't have to be Tony Siragusa. In fact, I'd prefer you're not Tony Siragusa. But you got to be somewhat interesting when you're speaking. And I think Troy Aikman's a good example of this. Aikman's not a personality, but Aikman is comfortable on camera and brings you analysis which makes you engaged. Man, Jason Witten did it. And I think about this. ESPN tried out how many guys for this job? Greg Olson was in there. Joe Thomas was in there. Kurt Warner was in there. He was upset he didn't get it. And they went with Jason Witten, I think, because number one, he's a Cowboy. That helps. The most popular team in the league. He's recognizable. I think he's a good guy. Everybody just loves him and adores him in Dallas because he's a great teammate, hard worker. And there's just no negatives to him as a football player. And I think that they believe that with work, he'll become better because he'll have the work ethic. But I got to be honest. Is it possible Jason Witten is going to be the most boring analyst in football? I mean, let's really think about this. Guys, if we go down this list here, Mraz, this weekend, you tell me if Jason Witten is more boring than the other guys here. Number one, Tony Romo.
He's way more boring than Tony Romo.
Of course. Trent Green.
Much more boring than Trent Green.
Rich Gannon.
I like Gannon a lot. Witten's more boring.
James Lofton.
More boring.
Dan Fouts.
Way more boring.
Okay, so that's the entire CBS cast. Every analyst, he's more boring than.
Okay, so that means Browns fans are getting a better, in theory, analyst than the National Monday Night Game.
Fox. Charles Davis.
Oh, Charles Davis. Way more better.
Way more better. Moose Johnston.
Okay, I don't love Moose Johnston as far as entertainment value goes.
Okay.
But
it's fair.
I still think Witten's slightly more boring.
Rondé Barber. That's okay. You don't like Rondé. That's fine.
I don't love Rondé on the broadcast. Okay. I feel, you know, that's Tiki's brother, but yeah, don't love him.
Chris Carter, I think that was his first game he did this past weekend.
Yeah, and the game lasted 7 hours, so I'm going to give an incomplete.
Troy Aikman?
No, I love Aikman. You know I love Aikman.
Chris Spielman.
Spielman says some crazy things sometimes, so I'm going to go with Witten way more boring.
Mark Schlereth.
I like Stink. He could plug a barbecue meat for 6 minutes, so I'll give him less boring.
Okay, so that's the entire NFL color analyst calendar for this weekend. That means that out of, I think it's 12, maybe 15 games, there are 15 pairings. You chose one guy who might be worse, because you don't like Rondé, and Moose Johnston is a push. And this is the number one analyst that they just hired for the premier Monday Night Football outside of Sunday Night Football, and I'm guessing you like Collinsworth better than...
Much better. And also, there was one more name in the ESPN try. It left out Brett Favre was supposedly not great when he did it as well.
Okay, and then who's the Thursday night crew now on Fox?
Well, it's going to be Buck and Aikman.
Oh, okay. So, there you go. I mean, and he got it over all of these other guys. I got to wonder, is this a shot and a miss by ESPN for Monday Night Football? Because Witten could right now be, and I know it's early for him, but did they hire the worst, the most boring analyst and the most uncomfortable analyst in football already? Because that's tough. It's a tough ranking already. When we come back, Jeff Perlman, author of USFL, the book about the USFL, Football for a Buck. DA, CBS Sports Radio.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Value, big upside.
He did the little sit trick, but I don't know about that. I thought it was cute, but I could see all the other handlers like, okay, we get it.
It's DA on CBS Sports Radio.
39 minutes past the hour. DA with you here on CBS Sports Radio. And I hope you're watching the simulcast as we speak right now at watchda.com. That is mobile friendly. Any device you can watch the show, watchda.com. Because if you are, you see me repping a totally vintage, legitimate, authentic, old school 1982 Michigan Panthers t-shirt, which I picked up in a Goodwill store in the greater Phoenix area covering spring training in 2007. 82, because this must be even before they played their first game of the USFL and they had just issued their earliest merchandise. Joining us here on the show, I did this in honor of him. One of my favorite sports authors. He is the author of a number of bestsellers. And now, a book about the crazy rise and crazier demise of the USFL 83, 84, and 85. Spring football into fall football into the ill-fated USFL, which had so much going for it. Football for a Buck is the book. And Jeff Perlman joins us on the show this morning. Jeff, good morning.
You know, even though we're speaking via phone, I can smell the Salvation Army thrift store from here.
I can, too. It's very pungent. Very.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Man, it's interesting because I know this was a labor of love for you. You document that in the book, but you've gotten a lot of attention for this book, and not only because of your accolades as a writer, but I think this touches on something. It touches a nerve. Why do you think so many people are so interested in a story about a league from 30 years ago?
I think it's a couple of things. Number one, for guys, you know, we're probably in the same age bracket-ish. There's a real strong nostalgia for the USFL. You know, forget like you just said, Michigan Panthers uniforms were just insanely cool. You know, just that aside, like the uniforms, the colors, the names, you know, the Outlaws, the Gunslingers, the Gamblers. And also, like, the league was just really gutsy and sort of adventurous. And, you know, they signed three straight Heisman Trophy winners. They started picking off guys from the NFL left and right. The NFL was legitimately frightened by the USFL and the threat it had. And it was this really exciting football. I mean, you know, the run-and-shoot offense, Jim Kelly and the Houston Gamblers. Like, that was some really revolutionary stuff going on. And I just think it really touches a lot of things that sports fans love.
I think you're right, and when it comes to the NFL, as you describe in the book, they nicknamed in the NFL circles the USFL the useless, and they would laugh and mock the league. But there had to be a moment where they really were alarmed because of either the money that was being spent, the type of players they were getting, the attendance figures of some of the teams. What was the first time, do you think, the NFL was alarmed at the competition?
Well, I think the first time had to be when Herschel Walker jumped to the USFL. He was a Heisman Trophy winner out of the University of Georgia, and it was really interesting. He was a junior, and he didn't want to go back to Georgia. He was ready to make money. He came from a very poor family in Wrightsville, Georgia. And at the time, the NFL wouldn't take him. They only drafted seniors. And he reached out to the USFL, and the USFL had this whole debate, what do we do? And they finally decided it was worth it. And the funny thing is, as soon as Herschel Walker started negotiating with the New Jersey Generals, the Dallas Cowboys found out about this and had a representative call Walker to see what they had to do to get him. And by then it was too late. He said, I'm committed to the Generals. So that was really a big blow. And the other one that doesn't get spoken about quite as much, you know, Jim Kelly was drafted by the Bills in 1983. And he had said beforehand, I do not want to go to Buffalo. But he felt trapped. And he was in the Bills. This is a true story. He was in the Bills' offices with his agent negotiating a deal with the Buffalo Bills. And Bruce Allen of the USFL, the Chicago Blitz, found out that Kelly was there, and he called the Bills offices, pretended he was a relative of the agent, and said, we have a family emergency. You put him on the line. Got him on the line and said, I know Jim doesn't want to go to Buffalo. You know Jim doesn't want to go to Buffalo. Walk out of there, and we will make you happy as a league. And they left, and the USFL said, you tell us where you want to go, and we'll make sure you go there. And that's how he ended up going to the USFL, and the NFL was pissed and terrified.
Which is amazing, but Jim Kelly ended up becoming a Bill after the league folded. You tell the story about Steve Young being courted by the LA Express, where the Bengals wanted to draft him number one overall in 1984, and he did not want to go to Cincinnati. He never obviously stepped foot in Cincinnati, but imagine Steve Young as a member of the Bengals. But was that one of the breaking points of the USFL when they tried to cobble together what they said was a $40 million contract for Steve Young?
Yeah, it's funny because there was a really misleading. You know, the USFL was trying to build all this hype. So they called it a $42 million deal. And what it really was an annuity, not that different than what Walter Payton signed with the Bears a few years earlier. And the owner of the LA Express was an absolutely insane man, a Bill Oldenburg. And he was just spending money left and right that he didn't have. And he gave Young all this dough, come to LA, and Young was a really good player, but they couldn't pay the bills. And the crazy thing is, I mean, they have Steve Young as a quarterback. They're playing in the LA Coliseum, which holds 90,000 people. Even with Steve Young, they're drawing about 6,000 to 7,000, maybe 8,000 a game. They held a Steve Young poster day. First 10,000 fans get a Steve Young poster. Only 7,000 people showed up. So he was a great player. But he wasn't at that point, his name alone did not change a league or change a franchise.
Jeff Perlman, author of Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. One thing that really piqued my interest in your book is how you noted that Howard Cosell took on the cause of the USFL as a pet project. He really wanted it to succeed. Why did he have a rooting interest in the USFL?
All right, first of all, he was kind of an Al Davis guy, and he hated Pete Rozelle, and he thought the NFL was kind of a thug. And he always rooted for the upstarts. He was just a guy who rooted for the upstarts. And he really sort of took to the league and the idea of the league. And he loved when they got Herschel Walker to sign. But he was also very injurious to the league. He was one of their key witnesses in the trial that ultimately doomed the league. And he showed up drunk. And he actually was on the stand, and he was intoxicated. And it went very, very badly for the USFL.
Man. So... Yeah. You know, you write about how there were some real misses, obviously, the Washington Federals, amongst others, really bad attendance, really bad teams. But then some teams really did well. And the first championship game in Denver was played between a team from Detroit, the Panthers, and a team from Philadelphia, the Stars. And it drew to a neutral site 50,000 people. How did they ever draw 50,000 people to a neutral site game of a first-year league?
Well, they hyped it big. The two teams that made it happened to be two teams that drew really well. So they actually drew a lot of fans from the two cities coming to the game. The other thing was, I mean, you have to remember who those teams were. Michigan Panthers. Bobby Hebert was a quarterback. Anthony Carter was a star wide receiver. They were really, really good. The Philadelphia Stars, Carl Peterson was their general manager. Jim Mora was their head coach. The best story to me in the USFL was Sam Mills, who was cut by the Toronto Argonauts. Then he was cut by the Cleveland Browns. Sam Artigliano, the coach of the Cleveland Browns, calls Carl Peterson with the Stars and says, I got a guy, you're going to look at him and you're not going to want him. He's a 5'9" middle linebacker. And Carl Peterson says, I'm not signing a 5'9" middle linebacker. He's like, trust me, just watch him in pads. And Sam Mills became, to me, I probably agree, a very borderline Hall of Fame candidate. And it was all, he came from Montclair State. He was teaching photo at East Orange High School when the Stars signed him. To me, stories like that really sold the USFL and the narrative of the USFL really well.
The talent of the league is extraordinary. And yep. I think about the XFL that's going to try to reboot or the AAF coming up in the winter. And if they had future Pro Football Hall of Famers, Steve Young, Jim Kelly, Reggie White, if they had these types of guys on their rosters, it'd be impossible not to watch. How extraordinary is really the talent that a rival league had in the NFL at that time?
Well, I'll put it this way. Gil Brandt, when he was with the Cowboys, he was asked at the time how many USFL players could play in the NFL. He's like, maybe a dozen. They ended up with 200 players jumping from the USFL to the NFL.
Yeah.
There was an ungodly... All right, I'll put it to you this way. This is the best example. I was watching a video a few weeks ago of Doug Williams playing in the Super Bowl against the Denver Broncos when he won the Super Bowl. He threw 4 touchdown passes in that game. One was to Kelvin Bryant. One was to Gary Clark. One was to Ricky Sanders. Doug Williams was an Oklahoma Outlaw. Kelvin Bryant was a Philadelphia Star. Gary Clark was a Jacksonville Bull. Ricky Sanders was a Houston Gambler. That is direct impact of the USFL on a team winning the Super Bowl. I mean, it's unbelievable.
And those are really good players. There was a lot of them around the NFL. You mentioned Sam Mills, Gary Zimmerman. I mean, the list goes on and on. How many really good players came out of the USFL? And I always think about this. Had they not tried to go to the fall season? Look, they had problems financially already. They had owners that were overspending. Donald Trump was one of those owners. But if they never challenged the NFL in the fall, do you think it ultimately would have worked?
I think what would have happened is you would have had a merger at some point. The thing that really haunts a lot of the USFL owners, and they didn't know it at the time, was the 87 strike. That if the USFL was around when the NFL had the strike in 87, you could have potentially had a massive influx of guys just saying, forget this, we're going to go to the other league. And I think you have to remember, you had a team in Baltimore in the USFL, you had a team in Tennessee, you had a team in Jacksonville, you had a team in Oakland. There were a viable four, maybe five, Birmingham, drew amazingly, teams that would have been, you know, pretty good fits for the NFL.
And that was only 2 years away. This happened in 85,
yeah.
And then the strike happened in 1987. There's a lot of effects of the USFL on football. They were the precursor of the two-point conversion. Obviously, they kind of broke open the financial structure of the NFL. When you look at the NFL today, run and shoot, you mentioned Mouse Davis. When you look at the NFL today, what do you think the lasting effects are from the USFL?
This morning I did the NFL Network, and I did Good Morning Football. And Nate Burleson is one of the hosts, you know, the former line receiver.
Yeah.
And I said to him, your career, you can look at the USFL, because what the USFL did, especially the Houston Gamblers, they brought in Mouse Davis as the offensive coordinator, and he brought in this run-and-shoot offense. And they found all these receivers who were 5'9", 5'8", some 5'10", who were really fast. And they found them from small schools, you know, Ricky Sanders, Gerald McNeil, Clarence Verdan, and they opened it up for them, Richard Johnson. And they had this, like, bing, bing, bing attack. And what you see in the NFL now, a lot of it, especially slot receivers, the Wes Welkers and the Wayne Corbett's, you know, and the small, quick guys, that really did not exist as a role. If you think back to the Steelers of the 70s or the Cowboys, they didn't have guys like that. The USFL created that. And that is a really big impact that goes unspoken about that league.
Jeff Perlman, Football for a Buck, the crazy rise and crazier demise of the USFL. I wonder also if it changed the NFL's outlook on fun, on celebrations, on allowing guys to have personalities. The USFL really encouraged that. At the time, the NFL was known as the No Fun League. Do you think it opened up the NFL's eyes to marketing in that way?
Oh, I do very much. Very much. If you look back at the USFL videos, it was preposterous. There were more backflips. There was more, you know, dancing in the end zone. There was more trash talk. The one thing the USFL did that the NFL was not doing at that time is they wanted you to get to know the personality. They wanted you to sit down with Bobby Hebert. You could get an hour with Bobby Hebert before a Michigan game. Like, they opened it up to the idea that players are worth promoting. It's not just about the emblem on the helmet. It's worth talking to these guys. So if you want to talk about the birthplace of guys like Jim Kelly, like Steve Young, becoming household names and developing their personalities, it's right there with the USFL.
Isn't it also hysterical that because the NFL won't license its footage to many places, when you watch commercials for, like, TV companies,
yeah,
or Zenith or Best Buy, you still see USFL highlights on the commercial? Isn't that great?
Wait, I got to tell you, it's the best thing ever. So the two guys who did there was a weekly highlight show called This is the USFL, This Week in the USFL, and it was Mike Tolan, who became a very well-known producer, and his partner, Gary Cohen, has had this really long career, too. And toward the end of 85, the USFL could no longer pay them. They just didn't have the money. And one day, one of the guys at the USFL calls Gary Cohen into his office, and he says, we can't pay you, but I'm going to give you something valuable. And he's like, what is it? He's like, I'm going to give you the film vault. And Gary Cohen is like, what am I going to do with this film vault of old USFL games? Nobody wants it. He's told me through the years he made $100,000 every year just off of that.
Wow.
Because if a TV company isn't the official TV of the NFL, they can't use NFL footage. I was watching Friday Night Lights. A couple years ago, I used to watch Friday Night Lights. And, you know, Julie Taylor's in the student lounge. And it was when I was working on this book, actually. And she's watching the Houston Gamblers play the Tampa Bay Bandits. I'm like, holy cow, that's amazing. So if you look closely, beer commercials, TV commercials, TV shows, SpongeBob, you will see USFL players.
I love it. This book is so cool, man. I so appreciate you writing this book because I am all in on it. Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL by Jeff Perlman, New York Times bestselling author. It's available now everywhere that books are sold. I know this was a passion play for you and a labor of love, and man, you crushed it. So congratulations, buddy, and thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's really an honor. Thank you.
Jeff Perlman joining us this morning here on the show. It's true. Just watch a beer commercial that doesn't have the NFL rights. Watch a Best Buy commercial or a Zenith commercial or a TV commercial or something watch and look closely, and they'll usually do just a quick snapshot, a quick piece of footage, no more than a couple of seconds, and you'll see it is not the NFL, and it's not the XFL, and it's not Canadian Football League. It is football from the mid-80s, and you could tell because the jerseys, the sleeves go way down past the elbow, big shoulder pads, and you say, boy, that doesn't look like the NFL. It's not. It's because it's way cheaper and there's way more freedom and access to have USFL footage 30 years later. It's amazing. So amazing. Yeah, I'm rocking my Michigan Panthers old school vintage tee right now as we talk USFL. That was fun. A lot of fun for me. When we come back here on the show, very interesting piece done by Forbes on the value of college football teams. And the state of Texas, the Longhorns just got leaped. We'll talk about it next. DA, CBS Sports Radio.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.